Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Australian-born New York City jazz guitarist and composer Quentin Angus. Dubbed the Lord of the Strings, we caught up with him about his new 2022 CD, The State of Things, a CD that is a reflection of the next stage of his career and fatherhood. He started his journey in Eden Valley, a small South Australian country town with a population of only 200, and since 2010, he has been based in the world's mecca of jazz in New York City. Since coming to New York City, he has received national and international recognition for both his guitar playing and composing. He's got a great story.
Hey, thank you for taking a minute out for Neon Jazz today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely.
Certainly the topic of the world right now is The State of Things, which happens to be the title of your latest album. And I'm curious, with the way the world is right now, I mean, it just seems like we're adding things on top of a pandemic and hopefully we're coming out of it. How does it feel to have an album come out right now? Probably at a time when we need art the most.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that since composing this song and the idea, other than the message of the song, the idea was to begin the piece of music with this somber melody and then news clippings of, you know, not so desirable news around the world, and it just keeps piling on. Like this was originally written in 2019, and we first performed it late, like December 2019. So the news cycle at that time was a couple of mass shootings in one weekend in the United States, a lot of things to do with race and ethnicity and mistreatment of different people and police brutality. And then it just got the news cycle just kept getting exponentially worse, and here we are today. So I think that when we perform it again, those news clippings at the start will need to be updated. Otherwise, it's just, you know, it seems like it needs to keep being updated to stay relevant. But the lyrics that Michael Mayo wrote, I think no matter what, they've stayed current.
Well, and you mentioned that this release is another a kind of christening a new stage in your life of fatherhood and your career as a teacher. So what does that mean? What are the kind of the side notes with that on this album?
This is the first album that I have vocals and lyrics. And I think that it's just, you know, being at peace with who I am and how I write music. And I think earlier on in my career, I was more interested in the intellectual side of the music and getting very technical and trying to play things in crazy time signatures and whatever. And I think that, you know, the reason I fell in love with music and even jazz as well, my first jazz guitarist I got into was Wes Montgomery, and it wasn't the technique I fell in love with. It was, you know, his sense of phrasing, his storytelling, the groove, the time feel. And I think that this album has just, I've been able to express that. So I just kind of let go of any preconceptions of what I was supposed to be doing and just wrote music that I liked and decided to have vocals and lyrics, which I think helps to tell that story.
So what do you hope the listener that either downloads or buys this ultimately gets from this project?
The overall message, I think, is a message of positivity. I'm often told that I'm unflappable and, like, no matter what happens, I'm just kind of this positive person. So I think although it has those messages of, like, the state of things, you know, and thinking of all of the things that are wrong with the world, ultimately, you know, you have to make a decision of all we can do is, you know, what's in our control, and we can control how we think about things and what we do and our actions and whether we're going to make a positive impact, even if there is, you know, all these difficult things that we're going through. So I think that's the overall message, that positivity through anything.
So what did you learn about yourself over this time of quarantine, over the last 2 years, the pandemic time, that maybe you didn't realize about yourself that will only make you that much stronger as you do promote a brand new album?
Oh, that's a very, very good question. You know, I think that I have learned that I need other people in my life, and in particular, like, musicians to collaborate with. I have found it extremely solitary. Like, I to be honest, I haven't written much music in the pandemic. I used to write songs all the time. I was always churning out ideas, and it's not to say that I haven't written anything, but But that's been a difficult process because it's hard to collaborate with people, and not being able to play in person with people was incredibly uninspiring. So I think I've definitely learned that from myself. My creativity is only there if I can, play with other people and collaborate with them in person. There's no substitute for that, for me anyway.
So if we go back in time and go back to your beginnings, you're from a very small town in Australia. How did jazz become your life? How did music become something that you would gravitate towards and pursue as a career?
Yeah, so when I was growing up, my mom is a classical piano player and my dad played bass in cover bands. So I always had music in my life and in my family. And I was always good at it at school. And towards the end of school, that was kind of all I was good at. So I decided I'm going to do this. It was almost by default. It was like the only thing that I was good at. So I decided to go to university for it. And when I went to university, I had to choose between, there were only two tracks. There was a classical music track or a jazz track. And so my guitar teacher at the time started giving me all these albums and prepping me for auditions. And to be honest, he was showing me things like John Scofield, Pat Metheny, and to me it just sounded, especially when they played outside, it sounded wrong. I was very confused. And he showed me an album of Wes Montgomery, and that was when I just fell, he was the doorway in, I just fell in love with the music. I absolutely loved like his tunes, the way he built a solo when, he'd start with regular lines and then add the octaves and then the chords, and that was my doorway in. And then fast forward, I became obviously very obsessed with jazz. I definitely checked out those former people like Scofield and Messini, and my ears developed to a point where I enjoyed that music and I understood it and I liked it. And then it just went from there. And then I think I was always just searching, like the reason why I moved from Australia was I was always searching for the next thing, the next teacher, the next place that could bring me to the next level. And it was an obvious choice to end out in New York. That was kind of the best landing space for me.
So what kind of culture shock was that for you? I mean, were you so elated that you were here in such a hotbed of jazz that it just kind of blended in, or how did that work for you?
Yeah, I think the culture shock, obviously there's no language barrier. I did change some of the pronunciations of words, but I think the biggest culture shock was, like you said, I was completely enamored by, oh my God, I'm in New York, there's all these amazing players, I was going to clubs all the time. But then that wore off after a while, and then I realized that it was extremely difficult to make a living in New York. And I think that people saying that New Yorkers are rude, I think that New Yorkers are busy and they're always like, it's difficult here. Everyone's just hustling around doing stuff. And so I definitely found that difficult to begin with. But, eventually, like anything, you start to make connections, you start to make friends, you start to have good opportunities, and it all kind of came together. But I think there was an initial moment after moving here when I was super excited, where it was very difficult.
So you have a PhD in philosophy, and I'm curious, that academic world and knowledge of what you have as a degree, match that up with something that's relatively cerebral and artistic like music. How do those come together and benefit each other mutually?
So the PhD actually, so it is a music PhD. So the degree it's a doctor of philosophy, but it was in music. That the PhD itself was based on phrasing and polyrhythm. So that was definitely when I was getting into the kind of more academic, nerdier side of or cerebral side of music. I could talk forever on the PhD, but it began with an analysis of John Abercrombie and Galard Hexelmann's playing. And I transcribed every single solo from every single album of Galard Hexelmann. And then I basically analyzed the phrasing and in particular the rhythmic aspects. And then I started turning those into my own exercises and kind of took it further and composed songs with those concepts and came up with new rhythmic concepts. And so I actually had to record CDs for that, some which never got released. That was when I started collaborating with Ari Honig, who's you know, one of the world's best at polyrhythms and that kind of rhythmically inspired music. And yeah, so anyway, that was the PhD. So that was definitely when I was more in line with instrumental music, exploring, you know, rhythmically the rhythmic rabbit hole, how far you can go down that.
So you've been taught by some pretty big people like, you know, Jason Moran, Nate Smith, Hal Galper, and you played with a lot of great people like Will Vinson and the list goes on. What have you learned from them about like the history and lineage of jazz and being a musician that you hold sacred that you not only protect but want to evolve further?
Out of all of those people, a couple of things. First of all, just playing with them. I think that one of the best things you can do, and I mean, I've been told this 1,000 times by people like Todd Kuhlman and Hal Galper, if you can be in a situation, right, where you're in a band where you're the worst person and everyone else is way better than you, it just brings you to a different level. And I think that lesson has been amazing. Like it makes your playing so much better, and it you're basically putting yourself into a situation where you can express yourself way more freely because everyone's playing on a level that just, you know, anything goes and it brings you up to that level. But in terms of career advice or like thinking of the lineage, I think that, you know, all of those people have gone so deep into the music, right? Like I remember another great teacher that I had, Randy Johnston, we were talking about playing standards, you know, and I was calling standards for us to play over, and any standard that was going to be mine, he was like, you have to go find the original score in the public library, you have to find the original changes, you have to find the original recordings, you have to go deep into the music. And I think, and now, you know, I've taken that methodology into my own music. So if there's a tune that I call, or if there's something, you know, that's mine, I really know it. And I think that's the main lesson I've taken away from them.
So you've been all over the world. You've been to so many countries to perform live, and hopefully now that we're getting back to it and things are opening up more, what are you hoping collectively, worldwide, all of us realize about the power of live music as we get back to it?
Yeah, I think that music is, you can't describe it with words, how musical performance can just make you feel and how it can touch you. Just yesterday I was listening to a song that Jacob Collier posted from a live performance of When the Sun Gets in Your Eyes, like an original song of his. And I was just, for whatever reason, that just really, really moved me. Obviously, I wasn't there, but it was a live performance. And I think that there's no substitute for that. Yeah, I think we've been deprived from those experiences. And it's not only the performance aspect, but I think the communal aspect of everyone coming together to watch a concert, you know, there's an energy there. There's an exchange between the audience and the performer, whether you're on either side, that I think is really special that we need right now.
Everyone has a perception or an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans, and your students. But ultimately, you live your life. You have a perception of who you are. Who do you think you are?
That's a great question. Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about this, like, especially after becoming a father, you know, taking teaching really seriously. I think that in terms of who I am, I think that I like to help people. So whether that is writing music that people can connect to in a way, like one way or another, whether they want to play it themselves or whether they listen to it, it helps them get through whatever. But I genuinely like teaching, and I like bringing people to the next level, whether it is, you know, someone graduating and trying to find a job or someone who wants to be a performer. I like being the person who can, yeah, just help a person get from A to B, and then, you know, hopefully on their journey they meet other people who help them get from B to C and so forth. But I think that's who I see myself as.
Wonderful, man. Hey, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking time out to talk about the album and your life and music. Good luck with everything as we move forward.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Australia, New York, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Quentin for his time, music, and story. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit neonjazz at youtube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the neonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.